Thank you for the introduction. So I will begin my presentation. As Laviar mentioned, I'm a lawyer, and I'm also an assistant teacher at the University of Lisbon. And I'm a criminal lawyer, and I teach criminal procedure. And so this is something that I've been working mostly with regard to legal hacking, mostly academically, because we have a very unclear legal framework in Portugal on these matters. So it's something everyone knows. It's used legal hacking techniques, but no one knows how and on which basis. As for undercover operations, yes, there is some relevant practical experience and academic as well. Right? And so I work specifically in cybercrime very often, and this is what I will be talking to you about in the next few minutes. So I will begin with a case that is relatively well known, the Timberline High bomb threats, to illustrate what will be my point in this presentation. So in 2007, there was this message that was received, an email that was received by several teachers of the Timberline High School that said, well, have a nice explosive day, and I hope everyone keeps their arms and legs. And another email saying, I will be blowing up your school. And another email saying, enjoy your life ending. And then another email saying, smoothies should be $1. Signed, your mom. And so after receiving this bomb threat, the Timberline High assumed that this would be probably a teenager threatening to bomb the school, but still they had to take it seriously because they didn't know either if it in fact was a teenager or if he had a bomb. And so they kept receiving emails. One of those was the following that you can see in my presentation, which is maybe you should hire Bill Gates to tell you that this email is coming from Italy. Ha ha, wait, I already told you that. So basically the student was taunting the investigation and taunting the school, saying, you will never catch me because I am using a proxy server. And in fact, he was using at least 4 different Gmail accounts, including thisisfromitaly@gmail.com. You will see some Portuguese words in the middle because of the autocorrect, but I will correct in the final version. IPs are from Italy and the Czech Republic, the proxies, and he created a MySpace page named Timberline Bomb Info. So the FBI was called. And the FBI was called with their behavioral analysis unit, which you may know from the Criminal Minds TV show. And they decided to pretend they were journalists. The FBI agent decided to pretend he was a journalist called Norman Weatherhill from the Associated Foreign Press. And he said, I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say. Would you please give me an interview? And he said, no. And then they decided to try again with a new email to this student saying, I know you don't want to be bothered by the press, but please let me explain. I don't want to know who you are. I just want to know what your message is, what you want to do. And so they appealed to his ego, which is usually the case. They went basically undercover to create a communication channel with the suspect, which they did. The answer came shortly. He said, how can I help? So if you want to interview me, how can I help? Well, and the FBI sent him a link. You should click here so that we could begin speaking. He clicked, and the link was infected with something called the Computer Internet Protocol Address Verifier, which is a type of, let's call it, malware created by the FBI that wanted to collect the true IP address behind a given computer, passing through all the proxies. Basically, what it did was if you clicked it, they could find out your IP. But it didn't work. Somehow it didn't work. At 5:07 p.m., they began chatting in Gmail, the fake journalist, which was in fact an FBI agent, and the suspect. At 5:50, they sent the fake journalist sent a link to this kid saying, well, I would like to illustrate my piece with a few photographs, but I don't want to choose any photograph without passing through your opinion. And so could you please give me your opinion on whether you think this should be this should be the picture that we would use. And he said, I don't care about which pictures you use. Of course, he clicked on the link. He clicked on the link to see the pictures. And in that case, the CPAV, the Computer Internet Protocol Address Verifier, worked. And so they managed to find out what was his IP address. At 2 a.m. the next morning, a search was made at his house. He was woken up. They arrested this kid named Josh G. It's a fake name, of course. A 15-year-old 10th grade student who was indicted and who was convicted for, of course, the harshest of the penalties was that he was prohibited to use his computer for what were, I think, a few months. Well, this case was in 2007, but things haven't gotten that different. In fact, in some cases, they have gotten harder because it's very easy for you to get online mechanisms that will allow you to hide your true identity and basically render useless several of the investigation techniques and the ways of collecting digital evidence that are put in place currently. So this was one of the cases where he just used Gmail, he used a proxy server, and no one could get him. But currently you have similar cases, and unfortunately I've been following a few of them with very little success, might I add, from the investigation, where someone just needs to use, for example, ProtonMail and send you a few emails, and ProtonMail collects very little evidence, and they also have a VPN. In some cases, they can easily put a pixel in the email so that they can monitor when you can open your emails, in which case they know that they are reaching you. And so they can just keep sending emails, and then they can go online and subscribe you to different pages and subscribe in order things in your name. And this is very frequently used in cyberbullying cases and in harsher cyberbullying cases. They can very easily find out information. They can send you text messages pretending to be someone else, basically through technology and through open source. Through open source technology and through every type of technology that you find available, which renders it very difficult for the investigation to find. And so, unfortunately, very often it's becoming necessary to use social engineering techniques, much like hackers do. So the investigation needs to begin using these techniques, but of course they cannot use it. They know it already. The investigation is already fully aware of it. But in some cases, the use that it's done it poses serious difficulties from the defense's point of view and from the reliability of the evidence that is collected. So we reached this preliminary preliminary conclusion, which is it's very easy to obfuscate where you are. It's very easy to hide your true identity online. So each time it's more necessary to resource to these types of investigation techniques, but not at all costs, as we'll see pretty soon. Well, you can see from this, I'm not sure if you are fully aware of the upper left square in this slide, but more frequently we have been seeing that it's very hard to find where the suspect is. In the upper left corner of this slide, you have something called Mercado Benfica, which was an online blog. It was a website initially on WordPress, and then it was transferred to Iran, and then it was transferred to other countries, to Ukraine, where they would leak emails from different people that they hacked, and then just put the whole mailbox online so that anyone could download it. And the investigation could not find where these people were. This was directly related to the upper right side of the link, which is called the football leaks, as you may have heard. And basically what you see in this is that you are being a victim of a crime openly. Everyone can see it. No one can take it down. There are not enough blocking mechanisms at the hands of the investigation currently, at least not in Portugal, and from what I know, not in several countries. The notice and takedown mechanisms are not effective in these cases. And even if you manage to block these websites, you still can't find the perpetrator, and you still can't prevent other people from circumventing the blockage that you put in place in your country and accessing the website. You can't take it down. You can't find out where it is, and you can't find out who did it in several cases. So you need social engineering, and you need technology. This happened also in the Silk Road case that you can see in the lower right corner. Though it is very questionable how they got to the Silk Road server, which was in Iceland, because they apparently, this is the official version, they exploited the leak in the CAPTCHA, in the thing that you write to prove that you're not a robot. And somehow, through that leak, through hacking techniques, they managed to get to the server and capture everything that was on it, including private communication between people on the Silk Road, and apparently my own login, which you can see in the upper right corner of that. I never bought anything, but I had to register in 2012, I think, to investigate a bit on it when I began my studies in these matters. It was actually a bit later than that. And also the Alphabay market. These are just some examples from drug markets online, from that the Alphabay has been taken down, Silk Road has been taken down, but you have several others. You had the Agora market, you had the Dream market, you had the black market, several others that in the meantime have been taken down mostly and very frequently due to these hacking techniques or to undercover operations. And so what is the difficulties that lead us to need increasingly to collect evidence in these manners that are, of course, more intrusive and, if we are very rigorous, less desirable in any free society? Well, the first problem that we find in the investigation is that IPs currently mean very little. And IPs used to be our main source of investigation. I mean, they still are in several cases, but they are less reliable. What you can see here is in the left side of the screen in a car, it's something called war driving. War driving it took its name from the movie War Games with Matthew Broderick. I'm sure you've seen it or heard about it. And it's basically people who are, you also have war walking, war biking. The main, it's always the same thing. The only the vehicle changes, which is you get someone with this hardware that you see connected to the window trying to find open internet connections. And when they do, they just sit in their car with the laptops using the internet connection to do whatever they want. And of course, if a search somehow occurs, if the police gets back to an IP address, they will of course do a search on the wrong house, and good luck proving to less tech savvy IT professional, legal professionals, such as, which happens usually with lawyers and frequently with judges and less with prosecutors, to that this, of course, someone used my IP, I have no idea how. And then you have in the right side, the Glen Park Library, which is a very interesting case. It's also related to the Silk Road. And it's basically the following. Ross Ulbricht, which was the creator of the Silk Road, at least he was convicted for being so, he was in the Glen Park Library using an open Wi-Fi, from the library to access the Silk Road, and which was a drug market in the dark web, as his administrator. And so he called himself the Dread Pirate Roberts. I'm not sure if you saw the movie The Princess Bride, where it comes from there. And he was accessing the Silk Road, and the police knew that he was using that IP address. And so they went there to the police undercover. They saw a young man that they thought was the person that they were looking for, because they had other hints. They saw him on the computer, but they knew that if they approached him, he would immediately lock the computer. They could not decrypt it. And so what they did was, this two officers simulated a fight close to him, while a woman that was sitting in the table on the other side of Mr. Ulbricht saw when he would look away. And the moment he looked away, she pulled the computer from him and captured it directly connected to the Silk Road web server. And so why did they do this? Because if somehow he managed to lock the computer, there would be absolutely no way they could get the incriminating evidence that they needed. And so this is the current problem. If they went just by the IP address, they would have gone to an open Wi-Fi internet connection, and they would have gone to an IP address that would lead them to different computers, to different people, if the library kept any records, because currently this is a frequent problem that we have. Even if we have data retention in place in several countries, which we still do, we don't have obligations from open Wi-Fi internet, at least in Italy they do, but from open Wi-Fi internet providers to keep any logs from people that are accessing your internet. So if the police get somehow back to the Glen Park Library, well, that's as far as you're going to get. So try to get the different information. If they have CCTV, then it's one way, but then it's very difficult to move on. You have free, easy to use anonymizing tools that will render it basically impossible to know where you are if you are careful. For example, in Tor, you usually, as you, this is already old news, you already know how this works. It's the Tor just jumps around different nodes with different encryption layers so that you cannot, once you know the communication gets to the end, you cannot see who accessed that website, for example. You cannot see the intercept the communication. You cannot know the origin. You cannot know the destiny of the communication. This is basically what Tor does. And then you have the Epic Private Browser, and you have FreeNet, which is a closed internet that is stored on people, on the user's different computers. And so it's even harder to identify what it is. So the main reason why people stop using it is just, it's not because it's ineffective in hiding your identity, which it's not. It's actually very effective. It's because it is so slow. And Tor is a bit slow as well, but not as much. But of course, there are ways for you to find out who is behind the Tor browser, if they use JavaScript. If you can even, there are even techniques that will allow you to see if you maximize your screen. They will know the size of your screen, which is circumstantial evidence that can be used if they, somehow they get to you. So they, you can see on Reddit and on different platforms on the dark web that you should not maximize your screen. You should not access you should not have JavaScript enabled, not only for that, but it's a source of several problems. So you should have your browser in different languages, so different obfuscation techniques. But still, if you don't need to know everything, you just need to know you have Tor, just download it and use it as you use Firefox, and it's the same thing, and you're very much protected. And now you have a no problem. Not that new, it started in 2009, but it's been a new layer of novelty in the past 2 years. So you know that most cybercrime, or at least quite a big amount of cybercrime, is money related. The exception is, of course, for child pornography, and those are usually cybercrimes that are more within communities, not directly related to money purposes, though in some cases, of course, they are. But now you have, if you want to sell drugs, if you want to sell weapons, you have Bitcoin, of course, you have cryptocurrencies, so you have tumbling, you have mixing to hide your origin. You can, if you want to pay someone and you know that your transaction will go on the blockchain, your source transaction, your end transaction, and the date of the transaction. And you can even put a bit of text that will be in the blockchain and stay there forever, which is why, small parenthesis, some people have asked others to marry them in with a small message in the blockchain so that it will stay there forever and probably longer than that marriage will last. And you have tumbling and mixing, which is, if you want to pay someone and you want this, all this information to go in the blockchain, you can put it in a tumbler, which means I will pay to an entity that will shuffle the transactions that he'll receive from various entities and then transfer the money to the destiny, so that you cannot know where the money, you only know that the money came from a tumbler, you don't know how it got there. And then you have new techniques of money laundering, for example, with mining pools, where you create a mining pool, and as soon as you get a mining pool, which in Bitcoin, which will ultimately let you receive a lot of Bitcoins, for example, you receive 12 and a half Bitcoins because you reach the code. I will not go very in much detail about the Bitcoin working because it's not the subject of this presentation. This is just an example. And so imagine that you have several people that want to receive free Bitcoin. So what they do is they allocate their computer power to a common network, and they will receive, in some cases, if they hit some sort of jackpot, a sort of lottery in Bitcoin, they will receive a prize. This prize will be a lot, an amount of Bitcoins. Currently, I think it's about 12 and a half, perhaps 625. I'm not sure anymore, because when was the last halving? But what happens is, if you enter a mining pool, you use your computer to discover this code that will ultimately lead you to receive the money. Well, some people just create mining pools so that when they receive the money, they keep the good Bitcoins, they send you the dirty ones. They send you the Bitcoins with that come from money laundering, that come from drug trafficking, for example. And then you think you just received a virgin Bitcoin, and there you have it when you try to use it in an exchange such as Coinbase or such as Kraken or Binance. You will see your account being blocked because they did an analysis of the blockchain and they saw that that money came from a dark web market. And then you have reverse loans, of course, which is a problem. You send someone 10 Bitcoins and they'll send you one Bitcoin every month that is clean. I will not go into the next two, but the last one is very important. Currently, you have something called the Lightning Network, which is coming up since 2018. It's been growing. It's very complicated in its functioning, very, very complicated. But you can have this idea. In Bitcoin, every transaction takes quite some time, and every transaction costs a fee. Costs some money. So this is the main problem of Bitcoin, is that it can only process a small number of transactions every few minutes. So what the Lightning Net, and also everything goes on the blockchain. So if I send one Bitcoin to you, this will go on the blockchain. If you send one Bitcoin to another address, this will go on the blockchain. Everything, it takes some time. The Lightning Network created something very interesting. It's a new layer above the Bitcoin network, which is you now send Bitcoins to the Lightning Network, where you have channels where you can trade network Bitcoins freely among your peers that are in the same channel, and only in the end will the result of those transactions enter the blockchain again. And so this is a problem for the investigation, because you can have Bitcoin sent to a channel where you have several people who are not in good intent trading Bitcoin among each other. And then when you have, what you have is not why the one Bitcoin sent to this person, the 12 Bitcoin sent to the other, the 13 sent to the other. You only have the end of this. You only have, for example, the sum of everything and the result of everything. One Bitcoin entered this address. And it's the ultimate difficulty for the investigation, because it will very much make it hard for registries and for the investigation to find what they want. Also, encryption, which has already been mentioning, the problems with altering metadata. You have this case of the Brazilian banker's crypto, cryptography, where there was an investigation on a Brazilian banker where he encrypted his information. They could not get it from him, so he was not convicted for the crimes that he was a suspect of. You have different technologies that would allow you to communicate with encryption that are very cheap. You have in the lower left side the symbol of Confide, which is one of the most advanced technologies for communicate. It has a protection against print screens, and you can only read it if you have a finger on the phone in each line. You have Signal, and then you have Eraser, which means that in the right side, that you, if you delete information, it will no longer be collected, which means that if someone is currently involved in some type of crime, they will communicate with Confide, with Telegram, with Signal. They will delete their information with Eraser, so that if somehow her computer gets seized, you will not be able to recover it. They will encrypt the most sensible information. They will hide their IP address, they will use Tor, and you will not be able to get much information, much less if they know that they are being investigated, which sometimes also happens. And so you also have, if you want to trade information, hiding what you want to send to the other person, It can be child pornography. It can be, for example, Bitcoin, a payment in Bitcoin. You can, as in the right side corner, you can do something called steganography, which is you hide information within information. You can hide child pornography video within a photography of a building, for example. And if an uninformed investigator is not aware that, for example, if this person has steganography software installed in their computer, probably they are hiding something. He will probably just see a photograph of a building and he will just ignore it. So usually you need to know what you're looking for, or it's not also practicable to investigate every single file to know if they have something hidden. And also because what is hidden under a password, which frequently you cannot find. And so you have, these are basically a few of the technical difficulties, a few of the anti-forensic techniques that will allow you, that will make it very difficult for the investigation to collect any information. But you have legal difficulties as well. And one tactical that I will approach, that it's not exactly anti-forensic. The first of all is jurisdictional aspects. No one seems to know currently if they can do searches, remote searches or not. So this is a discussion that I will not spend much time on, but basically there's just been quite a few discussion ever since before the Cybercrime Convention on the suspect, if a criminal investigator can just sit in front of a suspect's computer and access his Gmail account due to the fact that his Gmail account is in another country. This is a very old problem, and it seems very anachronic. It seems very difficult to understand in light of what we know today, but it's still a legal problem in several states. What's currently happening is that either legislators just ignore it, as happened in Portugal. They just deleted copied the Cybercrime Convention's provision that said that you could do remote searches as long as they were in your own territory. And now we have, you can do remote searches, period. They no longer mention if it's in your own territory. You can do as in Belgium, or as in they did, which is you can access this information if it's very urgent and it's abroad, and then you can notify the state if you find out where was the information stored. Of course, this never happened. No, not one single notification to a different state was ever sent, from what I heard. Or you can do as the United States do, and they access information wherever it is. But still, this is a problem, and I think it's going to increase with the new measures that are going to put into place with the e-evidence package, which will bring, it will try to expedite the collection of digital evidence between countries. But in that way, it will somehow admit that it's questionable that these searches can be done unilaterally. This is the biggest problem, I think, that we are currently facing, which is if you want to find out where an IP address, if you want to find out someone's IP address, some criminal's IP address, some suspect's IP address, frequently you cannot know it. Because if this IP address is in a country that revoked their legislation on the e-privacy, on the data retention directive, which means if they no longer keep the IP addresses, then you don't have information to investigate. This is a problem because the Court of Justice declared the Data Retention Directive invalid. And so several countries had to remove their data retention legislation. In Portugal, it is currently in the Constitutional Court being analyzed. But other countries just revoked it, and other countries have it. But if you have a communication that goes through different countries, well, if one of those countries does not keep their traffic data, most likely the investigation will not be able to follow with this lead. Finally, and this is the last difficulty that I will mention to you, there is a problem with carrier-grade network address techniques, which is in sum the following. You have IP addresses, but you don't have enough IP addresses for everyone. As you know, because there are too many people accessing the internet. And so what happens is that ISPs share IP addresses. And so there's even a famous case in the Netherlands where there were 60,000 phones using the same IP address. So good luck trying to find out who was behind that IP address, because in that case, the IP address, the ISP didn't even keep the registry of the information of who was accessing what. And so you get the IP address, you're very happy because you'll finally be able to find your perpetrator, and then you just have to analyze 60,000 people who are using the same IP because it's being shared. This is a problem, as you see, for the investigation, which is why, as I mentioned in the beginning, IP addresses are frequently becoming more useless, though there are still, of course, several cases that are solved based on them. And so we reach this conclusion from now that I already mentioned. It's very easy not to be caught currently. It's very easy. If you take the right steps, and if the police is not that invested in finding you, which they may be in some cases, but in other cases, if they are not terrorism, if they are not child pornography, the resources that are channeled to this investigation are frequently less than in the other case, which is normal. There are limited resources and you have to prioritize. And so still, ever increasingly, we need online undercover investigations. And this picture was, it's not very good, but it was taken by me last month on one of my nightly walks. It's in Praça do Comércio or Terreiro do Paz in Lisbon. The reason why I chose this is because it's a case that I had to work on a few years ago of an online undercover investigation, which was the following. You had a person selling, he was selling weapons, not pistols, of course, tasers and pepper spray, which isn't legal to have, of course, and illegal to sell unless you have a license. But they were doing this on an open market called the OLX, which is some like Craigslist or like sort of short, small Amazon. So he was selling this weaponry online. And so a police officer saw this, probably there was a claim, someone said this to the police officer, and so he started investigating. He decided to begin chatting with the seller. He said, "So what do you have to sell?" He said, "I have pepper spray, I have tasers, I have everything." He said, "Can you get, how many?" He said, "I have six of each. Can you get me some more?" "I'm not sure, but come on, I want some more." "Okay, so I'll sell you 12 of each." "Okay, so can you meet me at Terreiro do Paço on Saturday morning?" He said, "Well, I don't really have a driver's license, but and it's very difficult to go there, but okay, I'll catch the boat and I'll go there," because he lived in the other side of the river that separates the upper side of Lisbon from the lower side, broadly speaking. And so he did this. When he got there, he was arrested. And what you could see in the police report was, we got an anonymous tip that weaponry was going to be sold, but the buyer managed to run away. He didn't. He was the officer who arrested the person. And we caught him. And so we took him to the station. Of course, he was in the station. I think 18 years old at the time. And they said, "Well, let me access your email account." He said, "Okay." He accessed the email account. They accessed the email account, deleted every email that could prove that there was a communication between them. And then we went to court. Our only evidence was the defendant had the police officer's phone number. So we asked for the phone number for information on the phone number, who was it associated to, who charged it, who paid for it. And so and the judge suspected that something was not right in here. And so she called the police officer and said, "Why does he have your phone number?" And the police officer could not explain it. And so the case was dismissed because there was an illegal undercover operation. Well, why did the police, in fact, that police, there were different problems because the police did not even have the competence to investigate these crimes, which are attributed to the judiciary police and not to the National Guard. But still, no, it's irrelevant for this case. What is the problem here? Is that you can see how easily and how tempting it is to initiate an undercover operation. And if you don't have the means, you will try to do it anyway, which is what happened in this case. And it's the undercover operations put in place a series of risks that demand a series of guarantees. First of all, I don't even know if the police officers knew that this was an undercover operation, which is a problem in every country. Well, perhaps not in Spain anymore. Just when do we have online undercover investigations? When do we have an actual undercover operation? If you monitor a chat room just passively, if you just stay there and watch it, watch what's going on, are you on an undercover operation? Would a police officer be in an undercover operation if he just entered the coffee shop and stayed there, hearing everything? What's the difference between cyber patrolling, which is just passing through chat rooms and websites and trying to find some sort of criminal activity, and an actual undercover operation? This is clearly not easy to find, because we don't know when, if you speak publicly in a chat room as a police officer while hiding your identity, are you an undercover agent? Well, even if you're not, everyone in there does not use their name. It's frequently. So it's very difficult to import the realities of offline, let's call it, or real world undercover operations, and the realities of online undercover operations. So we need to understand that these are different things. The first problem is when is it the beginning? The Spanish law says that whenever closed channel communication begins. And so it's not exactly a good criteria, but it's a criteria. You can know that you have, at least in those cases, you have an undercover operation if you are chatting with someone, with the suspect. But then you have problems in here. If you post comments in online content, as happens, for example, in child pornography cases, where you have, they don't work in chats frequently, they work in posts. So you post something, someone posts a picture, and then someone comments, and then another person comments, and then they switch contacts. When you interact publicly with the suspect, is this already an undercover operation? Or you may not even know who is the suspect. You interact with a number of people to find out who is here to buy drugs or to sell drugs. If you record the communications that are on the chat, is it admissible or not? And also, you have new forms of entrapment, new forms that were not available before. For example, imagine that an undercover agent enters a chat room and his nickname is 12-year-old girl. And this is a chat room that is frequented by pedophiles. Or that he uses a nickname called looking for cocaine, for example. Could this be a new form of entrapment? Could he be soliciting actively that another person contacts him to sell drugs? And you have new realities. The undercover operation, the undercover agent, for example, he can be simultaneously and in different chat rooms, different personas. He can be the seller, and he can be the buyer, and he can be the pedophile, and he can be he can be the minor. He could be the same thing in different chat rooms at the same time. This does not happen in the real world. And then you have a new layer of difficulty, which requires, and which is particularly invasive, and which requires an autonomous authorization, I think, which is this. I'm not sure if, of course, you know the film, it's Face Off, and I usually use this example. Imagine, as happened in the Silk Road case, that the police somehow seizes the credentials of a person who is of trust of the leader of the dark market, and they use these credentials to leverage on the trust that has already been gathered by the true owner of the credentials to chat with the suspect. And so the suspect thinks that he's speaking to his friend, but really what he is speaking to a police officer who is undercover and trying to replicate his friend's way of speaking. I'm not saying this is illegal. I'm just saying that this is different from online undercover operations, from offline or real world undercover operations. You don't have this. And so this is particularly difficult to understand from a legal point of view, from an offline point of view, but it's still easy to understand if you see that this is different. You just need to realize that this is different. And if it's different, it requires an additional authorization from the judge. If this is to happen, the judge needs to say specifically that you are allowed to use someone else's credentials. Other risks that can be found and that were found in the case that I mentioned from Terreiro do Paço, but are also found here, is that it's very tempting for an undercover agent who knows how easy it is and who knows that the other party does not even know he's speaking to an undercover agent and is frequently speaking to other criminals. It's very easy to chat with him with the account that you have as an undercover agent and chat with him with a different account that you created all by yourself and try to extort that person or try to influence him or try to make him off the record give additional information to the official account. And so there is a very specific risk in this measure, which is as happened in the Silk Road case, the owner of the person who's being investigated, the suspect, can very well be extorted at the same time that it's speaking to the police officers, and he does not know that they are the same people, and he will never know. In this case, the Ross Ulbricht knew, for some reason, that the officers with whom he spoke online were actually officers who were with different accounts trying to extort him. This happened with Sean Bridges and Mark Force, who were in fact convicted for taking bitcoins from the Silk Road mastermind. This is a very specific risk from online undercover operations. And so there are we need a specific legal framework in general for this type of operations. We have in some cases, as in the Spanish criminal procedural code, for example, but we need, first of all, a judicial warrant for an online undercover operation to occur. It's not enough what we have in Portugal. It's not enough what other countries have. This cannot be an initiative from the public prosecutor. This could not be as we have. If the judge says nothing for 72 hours, then of course, then it's authorized. It needs to be a specific judicial warrant that needs to say, if in fact this operation is needed, how long will it take? What will you try to collect from it? What are the usable nicknames or the investigator may use? What are the computer systems or the locations from which the operation may take place? Because the investigator may not do this from his own home, for example. Not only is this a risk for him and for his family, but it's also a way to avoid being scrutinized. There has to be a list of actions that are authorized. And if the undercover operation agent is not from law enforcement, then the access to the credentials needs to be limited. He cannot know the credentials. You also need a clarification of the criteria for the existence of an online undercover operation, as happens in Spain. You need an obligation to disclose the existence of an undercover operation, which frequently does not happen, because in several countries, the undercover operations that are in place follow the same legal regimen that the offline undercover operations follow. And usually in the offline undercover operations, or in some cases, the suspect doesn't even know that there was an undercover operation. Even the trial judge does not know, because it's kept very secret because of the security of the undercover agent. But in online undercover investigations, this does not need to happen. The obligation to disclose an undercover operation needs to occur with adequate reporting of the undercover agent's action. You need to allow the undercover agent to send illegal content when strictly necessary. In some cases, if you want to access a closed platform, as happened, for example, with the Lolita City hidden service in the dark web, you needed to send child pornography images in order to gain access. Otherwise, you could not become an undercover agent. This is, of course, highly questionable whether the police can do this. But I mean, in Portugal, it's illegal, but it needs to be discussed. And if they are allowed to send illegal content, as happened in some cases with drug trafficking, where you are allowed to send to have a controlled delivery of drugs as long as you follow it and you know that you can capture the drug dealer, you need to allow for the monetization of the files as they are resent. You need to put a bug in these files, as is already in the law in some cases. You need to restrict cases where the infiltration is made with existing accounts. Not in every case can the undercover operation be authorized to use an existing account that is someone of trust of the suspect. And you need to keep this only for the crimes that are more serious. So I will rush through this next subject, which is the use of malware and legal hacking. This has been highly discussed in the past few years. You have legislation put in place, for example, in the United States. You have the Captatore Informatico in Italy. You have the Registros Remotos in Spain. You have the Online Durchsuchung and the Quellen Telekommunikationsüberwachung, I think. Sorry for my terrible German accent. In Spain. And so what is this? Well, you have this case called the Hacking Team case. It's a case that happened in Italy very shortly. This was a company that sold malware for the police to investigate the crimes. So they said the company sold to the police, and the police would use it to hack into computers and to use the information. Well, Hacking Team was hacked. And the Hacking Team, which is this company's name, they were hacked and their emails were put in Wikipedia. And so if any of you have had the chance to go there and search, you will find some very interesting communications, probably from your own polices to these entities. And what they used in this, what the software that they said was the remote control system Galileo, which allowed for a series of information to be collected, such as interception of communications. It could activate your webcams and microphones so that it would be used as a wiretap. You could activate the GPS to know where the computer was or the mobile phone was. You could install keyloggers so you could collect the passwords that person was using and use them yourself as investigator. Or you could record communications through instant messaging. So they were encrypted, but if you collect them in the source, they are no longer encrypted. And you could take screenshots of the user's activity to use in the criminal case. So the problem with this is that, for example, in Portugal, we have no legal regimen for this. So people are discussing whether it is admissible, whether it's not admissible. For me, it's very clearly not admissible, though I think our legislator wanted to create that measure in our cybercrime law, but he did it so shyly and so with such difficulty that it was not even our parliament understood what was in that legislation. It's what results from the discussion of the cybercrime bill. And so I think it's currently not enforced in Portugal, but there are, of course, very serious. There's the idea that this is used in Portugal, and there are reports of this. With the new strategy for prevention of corruption, this has been discussed, and it's supposed to be formally into law. In Italy, for example, for a long time, this was not into law. There were different decisions from the high courts, both admitting and not admitting it. And so it's still it was discussed until the legislation from 2018, where they created the Captatore Informatico, which was, it's not what the Galileo was. The Captatore Informatico is only for interception of communications. It's not, for example, the Online Durchsuchung that the Germans have, where you can actually search a computer system remotely and covertly. So what you need is to know exactly what you will be authorizing, what you want to be, what the defendant will have to face in trial. So you need to separate what are online searches, which is you search a computer remotely and covertly, and what is the use of an equipment to monitor its surroundings. What is, you can install a malware, or you can hack a computer to activate its webcam and know what's going on around, to activate the microphone and use it as your wiretap. But you need to separate it clearly, because these are not the same things, though you use the same hardware. It's restricted only to the most serious offenses. This is probably the most serious investigative measure that you can have in a state, and so you should be careful with it. And the judicial warrant should state clearly whether you have a law for it or not, what are the target devices, and what do you want to collect. You cannot just install it everywhere. What's the scope of the measure? Who are the suspects? What are the crimes being investigated? How long do you want to use the software? And which data are you looking for? This does not give you a permission to start a phishing expedition. Desirably, though this is frequently not used even in just regular search and seizure cases, the terms in which the data may be searched and accessed, who are the persons authorized to use it in a given investigation, and if there is an authorization to keep copies of the information. The Spanish legislators specifically created this requirement. Of course, you need a periodic review of the measure. This cannot be the judge signs off on it and then I'll see you in 2 years when you finish it. No, this needs to be evaluated every few months or every month, if so. You need to have a certification system for the malware, of course. With regard to the Galileo, you could find that when its code was released online, hackers started using that software. And then you need to have to make sure that the defense has the right to know what happened, to have all the relevant information, including with regard to the software that is being used, excluding that which is strictly operational. You need to create measures for uninstalling the malware, because I can assume that in some cases this will be forgotten, and the right of the defense to confirm that the malware used is certified, even if they do not have that information by themselves. There should be an independent third party who could evaluate it on their own. This is basically what should be used. And so this is just the ultimate chapter of my presentation, is based on the difficulties that I haven't found and that are exponentiated in cases where you have the undercover operation and every type of covert investigation techniques, which is you need to have legal safeguards put in place. First of all, you need to have reporting. Like once I was questioning a police officer that was that used some questionable investigative techniques, and I said, well, it's not, so you just created a file that you said that has the history that of my client's practices online. So you say that you have an Excel file created by you with every buy and every sell of drugs on the dark web. So, but you created this file, not my client, right? So why didn't you take a snapshot? Why didn't you download the page? Why did you choose to copy and paste it on a document that you created? And I got this question. Counselor, do you not trust the police? Well, this is not put in place. And of course, I chose not to answer that question. This is the case. It's not that you don't trust the police or you don't trust investigation, but you need to make sure that they did everything they were supposed to, and that somehow your defense may lie in their in the lack of appropriate investigative techniques. For example, in this same case where I asked the police officer, did you investigate, did you try to know if the Bitcoins were of a lawful origin? Or did you just assume that they came from drug trafficking on the dark web? And he said, Counselor, I'm here to investigate crimes, not to investigate legal activities. I said, okay, but the legal activities may very well show that the money did not come from crime. It came from a lawful origin. If you say that every month I have an amount of money in my bank account that came from a law firm, for example, where I work at. But you say, I think you traffic drugs and you receive this money in your account. So this money comes from drug trafficking. Of course, it could come from your wages, but I'm not here to investigate wages. I'm here to investigate crimes. And so in some cases, the investigation is biased, which is why you need to have case-specific notes that show every step of the way of what was done by the investigator, because it's normal that the investigator will look at the defendant as a guilty person and that the lawyer will look at him as an innocent person. There are different sides to the same story, and we both have our jobs. And so what we need to do is allow each party to do their jobs with the same information. And so these are the problems. You frequently don't have copies of the evidence collected until the end of the case. When you have copies, sometimes it's in proprietary format. So the police officer will send it to you, a software taken through NK, an image of a computer made through NKs, which is a software that only they have. In some cases, they won't even disclose evidence to you. Recently I had a case where the court would not disclose my client's email accounts for me to investigate. So there was eventually a mistrial because I was denied access to evidence, of course. If the defendant is in pretrial detention, imagine that you are defending someone who is accused of being a hacker, of money laundering with cryptocurrencies. Well, you need to have conditions for him to have access to the information to prepare the defense with you. He's the one who knows everything. The computer should be, and the evidence that has not been used in the indictment should be returned to the defendant. And whenever a copy is denied to the defense, it should be done based on the opinion of an independent expert, and in very, very strict cases that I can hardly imagine which would be. Also, the computer warrants need to be sufficiently narrow to avoid phishing expeditions. This happens very frequently. You put the investigator in front of a computer, he just searches everything. So what begins as a murder investigation ends up as a copyright indictment because you somehow had a copy of the Fast and the Furious in your computer that you should not have. It's also frequent that the investigator uses excessively broad terms and he finds evidence of different offenses. And so he just moves on from there. But this has to have there has to be a difference between phishing expeditions and cursory look. And either the search terms are previously defined in the warrant, or there is also a possibility, the search terms are recorded in the final report so that you can challenge them. And so I would terminate my experience with a brief mention that computer literacy is fundamental for every legal practitioner currently that is working in a cybercrime related case. The presumption of infallibility of digital evidence needs to be challenged, and the presumption that being tech savvy is being a cybercriminal. You may be careful about your privacy online and not be a cybercrime. I had a case where the prosecutor said, well, he used Tor, and who uses Tor does it for crimes. So physical world's experience, this is our land, is very rarely applicable to cybercrime. You need to have specific investigation techniques and specific knowledge on how investigation occurs online.